we must continue to delve deeper into the philosophy of nonviolent resistance. And that is something about it which causes the opponent not to know what to do.
This is Martin Luther King Jr.'s Path to Nonviolence, a special program featuring Dr. King's own words and conversations with two women who were close to King. In part one, we'll talk with Dr. Dorothy Cotton, who was education director for King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference for 23 years.
I can hear him so clearly saying now, injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere.
In part two, we'll hear from the late Dr. King's eldest daughter, Yolanda King, an actress and motivational speaker who's carrying her father's legacy into the 21st century.
I've been able to find a place where I can enter it and be fully myself, and at the same time, I think, make a real contribution.
That and more ahead on our program. Stay tuned. In a moment, Carol Boss talks with Dr. Dorothy Cotton about Martin Luther King's path to a philosophy of nonviolence. But first, Dr. King himself, from an undated public talk.
We must continue to delve deeper into the philosophy of nonviolent resistance. That is something about this method that has power. And I know that there are those who will ridicule it occasionally, but it has worked miracles in the South. It has morality with it because it gives us the opportunity to work to secure moral ends through moral means. This is the morality of it. But it has certain practical consequences. It exposes the moral defenses of the opponent, somehow weakens his morale, and all at the same time it is working on his conscience. It disarms him and he just doesn't know what to do with it. If he puts you in jail, that's all right. If he doesn't put you in jail, fine. If he beats you up, that's all right. If he doesn't beat you up, that's all right. If he tries to kill you, all right. You develop the quiet courage of dying, if necessary, without killing. If he tries to threaten you, all right. If he doesn't. And that is something about it which causes the opponent not to know what to do. Now, he would know what to do with violence. He could call out the state militia. He could call out the National Guard and kill hundreds and hundreds of innocent people and argue that they are inciting a riot. They know how to handle violence, but they proved over and over again that they don't know how to handle nonviolence. They try to handle it by throwing us in jail. But what happens? We go into the jails of Jackson, Mississippi, and transform these jails from dungeons of shame to havens of freedom and human dignity. Can't stop it. I believe firmly that this is the way. Now, that is another aspect of it, about this method. And people ask me about it all the time. So, what do you mean when you tell us to love these people who are beating on us and bombing our houses and kicking our children around? What in the world do you mean when you say love such people? And I always have to stop and try to define the meaning of love in this area. And interestingly enough, Greek philosophy comes to our aid at this point. There are three words in the Greek language for love. One of them is the word eros. Now, eros is a sort of aesthetic love. The philosopher Plato talks about it a great deal in his dialogues, the yearning of the soul for the realm of the divine. It has come to us to mean a sort of romantic love, and so we all know about eros. We've experienced it. We've read about it in the beauties of literature. In a sense, Shakespeare was talking about eros when he said, love is not love, which alters whence alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. It is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempest and is never shaken. It is a star to every wandering bark. You know, I can remember that because I used to quote it to my wife when we were courting. That's eros. That's eros. Then the Greek language talks about phileo, which is another level of love. It is an intimate affection between personal friends. Then the Greek language has another word called agape. Agape is more than romantic love. Agape is more than friendship. Agape is not something affectionate. Agape is understanding, creative, redemptive goodwill for all men. It is an overflowing love which seeks nothing in return. Theologians would say that it is the love of God operating in the human heart. And when one rises to love on this level, he loves men not because he likes them, but he loves every man because God loves him. He goes on with that. And so he rises to the level of hating the system rather than the individual who is caught up in that system. He loves the person and hates the evil deed. Yes. This is the way that we will get out of this dark night of oppression and make of this nation a better nation. It means that we can stand up and allow the opposition to know that we will not accept injustice. Yes. We will stand up against it with our lives, but we will never stoop down to the level of violence and hatred. And we will come to that point when we will be able to convince him that a new world is emerging.
You're listening to Martin Luther King Jr.'s Path to Nonviolence. I'm Paul Ingalls with Carol Boss. Dr. Dorothy Cotton says she met Dr. King around 1959, when King came to her town of Petersburg, Virginia, to lend support to an effort there to lift a ban on blacks using the public library. Dr. Cotton went on to become education director for King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference. She told her family she'd be in Atlanta for just a few months and ended up staying 23 years. Dr. Cotton spoke to us from her home in Ithaca, New York. Carol Boss first asked her about the evolution of Martin Luther King Jr.'s nonviolent philosophy of civil disobedience.
Dr. King himself talks about, as a child, witnessing other poor youngsters around him. Dr. King came from a comfortable family that is economically comfortable. His father pastored a popular church. And Dr. King's economic and material needs were met, but he noticed so many children whose needs were not met. In other words, he witnessed poverty around him and in the environment, both in Atlanta and places that he was able to travel. And then Dr. King went to Morehouse College, and at Morehouse, he read Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience. Dr. King himself talks about the fact that he was really inspired and motivated by this essay on civil disobedience. So he read it several times, and that was his first exposure to nonviolent resistance. Now here he's just kind of on an intellectual journey to and through nonviolence. And then Dr. King ends up at Crozier Seminary after graduating from Morehouse College. He now was in a serious search for a way to eliminate social evil, because the poverty that he saw, he realized, was not because people didn't do work, that there was something wrong in the society. Most importantly, again, this is still on this intellectual journey, he heard Dr. Mordecai Johnson speak at Howard University. Dr. Mordecai Johnson was the president at the university, and Mordecai Johnson had just returned from India. And Dr. Johnson spoke of the life and teaching of Mahatma Gandhi, and Mahatma Gandhi's working to remove India from the yoke of British rule. And he became fascinated by Gandhi's campaigns of nonviolent resistance, and you know, the salt march to the sea and Gandhi's fast. And after hearing Dr. Mordecai Johnson, I remember that he said he ran out and he bought a half a dozen of books on the life and work of Mahatma Gandhi. And he studied Reinhold Niebuhr. And again, he didn't agree with all of these people that he was studying, but he found something in all of them. And especially as he focused on the Sermon on the Mount and really began to look at different interpretations of love, that, you know, the three Greek words for love, eros, philia, and agape. But what he wanted to emphasize was agape, and that this really was the essence of nonviolence. And so he now moves from this intellectual sojourn to bringing it alive and understanding that this interpretation of love meant understanding, redeeming goodwill for all people. And And so he realized that if agape is the essence of nonviolence, then we must have love in action. And so it was right that he would respond to the people's protest against the way they were treated, in this instance in Montgomery, Alabama, the way black folk were treated on the buses.
For him to arrive at his decision to oppose the war in Vietnam and his position on nonviolence took, I would imagine, a lot of soul-searching and prayer on his part. And in his address, the historic address, A Time to Break Silence, he says that calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. And I was wondering if you have a remembrance to share of that time and what it required of Dr. King to essentially transform his consciousness to stand against the nation and oppose the war.
Well, I can hear him so clearly saying now, injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. You know, even ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. That if there is violence, if there is injustice anywhere, we must find a way to respond to that. He could not limit his talk, his work, his preaching and speaking and teaching against injustice. He could not limit it just to the place where he dwelt, for example, just in Montgomery. That was so powerful an event and impressive upon his mind and his very being, and that of all of us who worked with him. Well, really not all of us, because there were folk in our midst, even on his board of, on the board of directors of our organization, who didn't think Dr. King should speak about international events. But again, he did his own soul searching. He decided that the man had great integrity. He decided that he had to speak out against it because he saw it as just a grave injustice against those people in the people of Vietnam, and a grave injustice against the people from our own country who were being killed, slaughtered there in an unjust war.
What would be Dr. King's assessment of where his vision of a beloved community stands in our world today, the beloved community being where people committed to nonviolence can create a new social order based on justice and love?
Well, Dr. King was a visionary. He saw the possibilities, and even though he admitted and would admit today that we have a long way to go, I believe he would admit today and would actually say that if we think that nonviolence isn't working, we can make the analogy of pouring a bucket of water on a burning house. That if that bucket of water doesn't put the fire out, it doesn't mean that water does not put out a fire. It simply means that we need more water. And for me, that always makes a very strong and clear point for me. So as we see, the violence in the world today, we need to look at that. And I think Dr. King simply would teach and preach and speak even more strongly than he did in the days when he was actually with us. I think he would ask questions like, he was grounded in Christian theology. Thou shalt not kill should apply not just to individuals, but that it should apply to nations. And I think that he would use his last bit of energy to try to get that message out and talk about the fact, preach and teach about the fact that we must have a revolution of values and really work to change our thinking. I saw him as someone who would not give up his philosophy. He has indeed said, if I am the last lone voice calling for nonviolence, that I will do. And I believe that that's what he would be doing today.
No, my friends, if that is any one thing that I would like for you to remember this evening, it is the fact that somebody must have some sense in this world. Somebody must have sense enough to meet hate with love. Somebody must have sense enough to meet physical force with soul force. And if we will but try this way, We will be able to change these conditions, and yet at the same time win the hearts and souls of those who have kept these conditions alive. And I know the temptation. I know the temptation which comes to all of us. We've been trampled over so long. I know the temptation that comes to all of us. We've seen the viciousness of lynching mob with our own eyes. We've seen police brutality in our own lives. We are still the last hired in the first five. So many doors are closed in our faces. And that is a temptation for us to end up with bitterness. And I understand these people who have ended up in despair. I understand why there are some who have been a little misguided, and they've ended up feeling that the problem can't be solved within. And so they talk about racial separation rather than racial integration. I understand their response. I have analyzed it psychologically, and I understand it. But in spite of the fact that I understand it, I must say to them in patient terms that that isn't the way. I must say to them in patient terms that black supremacy is as dangerous as white supremacy. And God is not interested merely. God is not interested merely in the freedom of black men and brown men and yellow men. But God is interested in the freedom of the whole human race and the creation of a society where all men will live together as brothers. No, we need not hate. We need not use violence. That is another way. A way as old as the insights of Jesus of Nazareth. As modern as the techniques of Mohandas K. Gandhi. That is another way. A way as old as Jesus saying, love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Pray for them that despitefully use them. And as modern as Gandhi saying, through Thoreau, non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. That is another way. A way as old as Jesus saying, turn the other cheek. And when he said that, he realized that turning the other cheek might bring suffering sometimes. He realized that it may get you home bombed sometimes. He realized that it may get you stabbed sometime. He realized that it may get you scarred up sometime. But he was saying in substance that it is better to go through life with a scarred up body than a scarred up soul. That is another way. This is what we're about to see. No, that is a power in this way. And if we will follow this way, we will be the participants in a great building process that will make America a new nation. And we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. This is our challenge. This is the way we must grapple with this dilemma. And we will be a great people. And let us have faith in the future. I know it's dark sometimes. And I know all of us begin to ask, how long will we have to live with this system? Yes, I know all of us are asking, how long will prejudice blind divisions of men, and darken their understanding and drive bright-eyed wisdom from her sacred throne? When will wounded justice, lying prostrate on the streets of our cities, be lifted from this dust of shame to reign supreme among the children of men? Yes, when will the radiant star of hope be plunged against the nocturnal bosom of this lonely night and plucked from weary souls the manacles of death and the chains of fear? How long will justice be crucified and truth buried? How long? I can only answer this evening, not long.
We're talking with Dr. Dorothy Cotton, who worked closely with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the 60s. Was receiving the Nobel Peace Prize in 64 the point in Martin Luther King's evolution at which he began to envision himself as not only a Southern civil rights leader, but as a man obligated to promote his belief in peace to the global community?
Well, I think, you know, as he evolved, he saw that, as I said, he saw that he had to speak out against injustice anywhere he saw it. And I don't think that being in Oslo, Norway, to receive the Nobel Peace Prize helped him to, you know, to see that he was seeing already, because he was called upon from so many places now. People were hearing his voice. He was so grounded in, for example, the teachings of Jesus and Christianity, and he saw the connection between the teachings of Jesus and the suffering of people everywhere. It all flowed together and flowed into one grand picture and one grand peace and one grand calling for him. So I don't think he separated. I know he didn't separate himself as, you know, local Montgomery leader, as, because people were calling for him now, not only in this country, but even in other countries. People wanted him to come and speak and talk to them. There's a real interesting example of a white man from the Appalachian area here in this country who called our offices one day and said, I need to talk to somebody high up in SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And I have a big joke going with Andrew Young around this, because when the man said he wanted to talk to somebody high up, I called Andrew Young. I said, Andy, I had a big laugh with Andrew, and still when I see him, because, you know, the women's movement had not happened. So I was calling Andy thinking he really wanted to talk to a man on our staff. But I went to have lunch with this man, and he told me at the beginning of our having a meal together at the one place where black folk could go have lunch, we went into Pascal's restaurant, and he began by saying, I want you to know I have hated Dr. King. And why do you hate him? And he said, because he is leaving us out. And so, you know, I explored with him what he meant by that. And our focus really was on, you know, black folk, because we lived in this American-style apartheid, for example. That was the, you know, so the environment of our being and our existence. And but after talking with this man, that helped drive home the need to expand our vision, you know, to see that there were people not only in Alabama and Mississippi, that is black folk in those places, but there were people in other places who didn't look like us, who needed, who wanted to be a part of this challenge and this movement to change their lot in life. It was true for this man and this preacher, Preacher Red, as he called himself. It was true for him as he watched what we were doing. When he saw people in motion, he wanted his people, too, to redesign and redefine, rather. He wanted his people in Appalachia to redefine who they were. And he saw Dr. King as becoming his leader. But we hired a white guy on our staff, and he went to work recruiting people to come to the citizenship education workshops that Andrew Young and I conducted together with some other people as well.
Dr. Cotton, let me ask you if you can think of any current examples to illustrate how his principles, his teachings, his vision has been practiced effectively.
Well, I think if we wanted to really look at other countries, we could look at you know, Latin America and see, you know, I remember in Chile, for example, the nonviolent movement against General Pinochet. Mm-hmm. One little strategy they used, for example, one night when they knew that the oppressors were coming to arrest and probably do worse to the people who were leading that struggle there, they had so organized, and this is just maybe a small strategy, but everybody in the neighborhood started banging pots and pans. It sounds silly even, but it frightened, when they heard this huge rumble, it so frightened these people who had come to take away the leaders of the opposition that they left and didn't do damage. I don't mean to be simplistic about it, because it wasn't just that. You know, it was many things. Even when we look at a situation like, in 1989, Tiananmen Square in China, you know, I think it was not an end, but a beginning. Dr. King taught that unearned suffering is redemptive, and I believe that you know, that movement and that dream for freedom is alive and well. We have signs of that. And, you know, look at the Dalai Lama, who still, after all these years, reminds his followers that the nonviolent way will, in time, bring concessions from China that are even unimaginable at present. Oh, hey, we have a wonderful example in South Africa, don't we, where there were decades of resistance to apartheid, and slowly but surely it wore away the stones of oppression. And if anyone would read Nelson Mandela's Long Walk to Freedom, for example, we see that, you know, you can't put a time limit on a nonviolent campaign. And I believe that that is indeed true.
I would imagine that Dr. King continues to influence and inspire the work that you do today. And I was wondering if you can talk briefly about that and maybe tell us about the National Citizenship School for the 21st Century.
Well, I was working with some people actually at the University of Minnesota, where Dr. Harry Boyd and Peg Michaels were doing some work there at the Humphrey Center at the University of Minnesota. And they had me come up. I went up quite regularly, actually, for the last few years. And they were really intrigued by what we did in the citizenship education program. And we came up working together. We came upon the notion that we need citizenship education also in the 21st century, where we could get people understanding, again, in our institutions, working from the ground up in the places where they are, teaching what it means to be empowered citizens, what it means to be an accountable member of society. I think, as we look at politically what's going on in the country today, that we abdicate both our responsibility as citizens, and we give up all of our power and forget that we do have power, but only if we understand our power. In other words, the people and the leaders really flow together. People understand that elected officers, simply put, work for the people. Otherwise, it's not democracy. I think that we are losing that today, and we need to move back to a place of understanding, of having the citizens, of having people in mass understand what it means to be a functioning, obligated member of society. And that's why we need citizenship training for the 21st century to meet the needs and challenges of this time.
Dr. Dorothy Cotton, thank you so much for joining us today.
Carol Boss, you're thanking me, but I really want to thank you, Carol Boss, for inviting me to be a part of this broadcast. I was very pleased to be invited to be a part of it. Thank you very much.
Keep on walking, yeah, keep on talking.
Carol Boss with Dr. Dorothy Cotton, former education director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, founded by Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. Cotton later went on to serve as vice president for field operations for the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change in Atlanta. She's also served as a consultant to numerous organizations, corporations, and schools on topics including race relations, nonviolence, and diversity. In part two of our program, a conversation with the eldest daughter of Dr. King and Coretta Scott King, Yolanda King. Dr. King's speeches heard in our program came from The Wisdom of King, a Black Label Incorporated cassette collection no longer available. Music from U2 and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee Freedom Singers. I'm Paul Ingalls. This program was produced by Good Radio Shows Incorporated, online at goodradioshows.org.
Victory, my Lord, we shall not be moved.
I woke up this morning with my mind
set on freedom.
This is Martin Luther King Jr.'s Path to Nonviolence, a special program featuring Dr. King's own words, and now in part two, a conversation with the late Dr. King's eldest daughter, Yolanda King, now an actress and motivational speaker who's carrying her father's legacy into the 21st century. In a moment, Carol Boss talks with Ms. King, but first, Dr. King himself telling a story about his daughter in a public talk from about 1962.
My little daughter loves to ride to the airport with me. She says to me so often, "Daddy, you just go over and over and over again." And so one of the ways she consoles herself in the fact that her daddy has to be away so much is to ride to the airport whenever I'm going in or coming back into town or going out of town. And she can do it if she isn't in school. And as we pass on the expressway going to the airport in Atlanta, we pass by what is known as Fun Town. Now, this is an amusement center where little children go to play and where they go for recreation, something like Disneyland and something like the very fine amusement centers across the country for young people. And as we pass Fun Town so often in the car, she would look over to me and say, "Daddy, I want to go to Fun Town." Well, I could always evade the question when we were going by in the automobile because we were passing by and I could jump to another subject. And I didn't want to have to tell my little daughter that she couldn't go to Fun Town because of the color of her skin. But then the other day we were at home, and like most children, she likes to look at television, and she was looking at television, and they were advertising Fun Town, and she ran downstairs and said, "Daddy, you know I've been telling you I want to go to Fun Town, and they were just talking about Fun Town on the television, and I want you to take me to Fun Town." And oh, I stood there speechless. How could I explain to a little six-year-old girl that she couldn't go to Fun Town because she was colored? I had been speaking across the country talking about segregation and discrimination, and I thought I could answer most of the questions that came up, but I was speechless for the moment. I didn't know how to explain it. Then I said to myself, I've got to face this problem once and for all. And I took her and called over. My wife was sitting on the other side of the table, and I took my little daughter and told her to have a seat on my knees. And she jumped up in my lap, and I looked at her and I said, "Yolanda, we have a problem." I said, "You know, some people don't do the right things, and they are misguided. And so they have developed a system where white people go certain places and colored people go certain places. And I said they have Fun Town like that so that they don't allow colored children to go to Fun Town." And then I looked at her at that point because I didn't want her to develop a sense of bitterness. I didn't want her to grow up with a sense of hatred and bitterness in her heart. And so I had to rush on and say, "But now all white people aren't like this. There are some white people right here in Atlanta who would like for you to go to Fun Town. And there are some all over the country who are right on this issue. But still there are those who have been misguided." Then I looked down into her eyes. And I said to her at that point, and I saw tears flowing from my eyes at that point, I said, "Yoki, even though you can't go to Fun Town, I want you to know that you are as good as anybody who goes into Fun Town." And I want you to know, Yoki, that some of us are working hard every day to get Funtown open and to get many other places open. And I say to you that in the not too distant future, Funtown and every other town will be open to all of God's children because we're going to work for it.
Now, Yolanda King herself, whom we reached at the Culver City, California offices of her Higher Ground Productions, a company which states as its mission to help people find greater inner peace, to empower people to love themselves enough so they may begin to love others, and to create unity by celebrating diversity. Carol Boss asked Ms. King to recall what kind of dad Dr. King was at home, and as you'll hear, it sounds like she eventually found her way to Funtown, or at least some satisfactory amusement park, with her father.
My father was a buddy daddy. He really spent most of his time with us playing, having fun, doing things that children love to do, which is, of course, play. He didn't believe in spanking kids. Of course, my mother said if he had spent more time with us, he probably would have changed his mind. But when he was with us, he really just loved us, loved on us, and the time was short, but it was quality time. And so my memories are just full of a lot of laughter. My dad was really quite a funny man. The masses, of course, don't get to see that side of him because so many of the images that people remember are very serious and somber, and he's oratorical and he's really about business. But when he was not about business, he was a bit of a cut up. He was a jokester. He loved to tease. He loved to laugh. He probably could have been quite an athlete as well. He loved all kinds of sports activities, so we did a lot of that. Playing, he taught me to swim when I was four, and taught me how to ride a tricycle and then into a bicycle, and we played basketball and baseball, and I went to the local amusement park, and he and I, the two of us, because I was the firstborn child, would ride the dangerous shake-you-up rides. He'd call them faith machines, mm-hmm. And we'd get on them and just have a ball. He was a big kid. I realize now that those were the times, some of the few times, that he had to really kind of let his hair down and relax. And so that playful side of him, which was very much a part of who he was, he shared with us. And I'm thankful for that because I don't remember the Martin Luther King Jr. that I know, the daddy that I know, is a very different person from the Martin Luther King Jr. that everybody reveres.
How old were you when you felt you really understood the impact of your father's work? Was there a year when you knew it had clearly influenced the personal direction you would take in life?
I probably was in my 20s. I struggled with a lot of the legacy for a long time, probably actually into my 30s before I really made peace with it. Because, needless to say, when you come from such a tremendous legacy, there are awesome responsibilities and expectations, even more importantly, expectations that people have of you. And I really didn't feel that I was meeting those expectations, that I could meet them. And yet I felt there was a part of me that very much wanted to meet them. And so that was in conflict a lot, trying to be all these different things to all these different people, and it just was a recipe for a feeling of worthlessness and failure and not really being really up to par. And so I've been able to find a place where I can enter it and be fully myself and at the same time, I think, make a real contribution to carrying on the ideals, that the values, the principles that my father and my mother have lived for.
Do you consider the work that you do an evolution from his work?
I do. I do. One of the programs that I'm most proud of that is a relatively recent launching through my company, Higher Ground Productions, is the Inner Peace Circles, where we work with people on a monthly basis. We offer a teleclass and actually share with people the principles that I feel are really invaluable if one is going to attain a place of inner peace. Because where my father was trying to take us as a nation, as a planet, this place of peace, this place of brotherhood and sisterhood, this world house that he was trying to create where people could live together in peace and justice and with the kind of respect and appreciation for each other. I think we're not going to ever get there if more and more of us, until more and more of us, really understand how important and what our responsibility is to find our own place of inner peace and to deepen that peace, because I truly believe that it reverberates. Where if you are able to carry that place and embody that place of peace, then it obviously contributes to wherever you find yourself, in your home, in your workplace, in your community, in every aspect of your life. And if more and more of us are really committed to doing that, I think it can really make a real difference on the planet. And so that's one of the programs that where I have focused my attention, and I do see it as an evolution, obviously, of what I learned at home, what I learned as a child growing up with these parents who not only talked peace and talked about how important it was to make a contribution and that you should be your best self and that you should show your best side and you should look for the best in others, but they lived it, and it took root in me.
What are some of the key components to achieving inner peace?
Well, one of them is we do a whole lot of self-talk that many times we're not even aware of that disturbs our place of peace. We buy into the chaos. We buy into the conflicts. We buy into the craziness. And if you listen to yourself, there was a time when I even recorded myself just to get an idea of some of the things that I would say during the course of a day. And I would just really pay attention to things that would come out, and I realized that I was speaking words. I was speaking about things that exacerbated my discomfort as opposed to supporting a place of ease and a place of grace and peace. And so that's one of the things when I hear people saying, you know, oh, I'm crazed. I'm just running around like a chicken with my head cut off. Well, yeah, if you keep saying that, guess what? That's exactly what you manifest. And so that's one of the tools that I have learned, as well as meditation. Meditation is such an invaluable, incredibly significant tool that takes time. It takes a real commitment and discipline. But my gracious, the benefits are just tremendous.
If you could talk for a couple of moments about your 21st century take on race relations. You've said before that you don't really espouse a colorblind society, that it's naive and probably unhealthy. Can you elaborate on what you mean by that?
Well, I think I remember seeing a T-shirt about a couple of years ago, and it said, "Love sees no colors." And I remember thinking, well, that doesn't really express what love does. Love loves all colors. Love sees everything. Love appreciates and radiates and encompasses and embraces everything. So to pretend that we don't see, I think it's not healthy and it's not natural. And I don't think we as humanity can ever reach that place, because I think it's a very unrealistic way of looking at the world. In fact, we should really actually be more tuned in to the beauty, the diversity, the different colors, the rainbow, this potpourri of of vibrancy that is the human family. We need to focus on an appreciation of these incredible differences, because they are always going to be there. They're not going away. And if we try to pretend that they don't exist, then obviously we're going to come up and bump heads and have all of these conflicts. We're always going to be different. And so I think we need to teach instead an appreciation for the fact of our differences.
Do you have ideas about how we can do that in this society?
Well, it has to start, obviously, and one of the places has to be within our school system, that we have to have structured courses of study that really allow the whole story of humanity, the whole story of the various the races and cultures and histories that have come together to create this incredible human tapestry. Part of, I think, the reason why differences are not as appreciated is the fact that there is a tendency for us to try to look at one story or one side of things and to shape everything from that place and from that perspective. As a culture, if we could begin to, and not only here, I mean, this is not just an American problem, obviously. This is a human problem. If we focus on the totality, try to focus as much as we can on the totality, I think then we see naturally that there are just this wealth of really wonderful treasures that have come from our differences. I mean, thank God for the differences. What has been created as a result of these tremendous differences, I think, is where we need to focus. And of course, our schools have to take a leading role, play a leading role in that. I believe in that transition and in just helping young people to begin to learn and to appreciate and to grow.
You utilize your talents in the arts as a bridge to peace. In your vision, how can the arts help to make a tangible difference and help create a more peaceful world?
I am convinced, and in fact I have seen it happen in my work over the years, utilizing artistic mediums really to not only entertain but to educate. Edutainment is what I call what I do with utilizing artistic vehicles and elements and aspects. I don't have to even talk about how powerful music is, popular music is in our culture today. It has so much influence and impact on the minds and the hearts and the spirits of young people. If that music, if those images, if those lyrics could be focused in a very specific direction, how powerful it would be in really helping to instill the values that are necessary for well-being, for positive growth, for a real sense of peace, even in our world. Instead of, unfortunately, many of the lyrics, I think, really perpetuating a place of dis-ease, not disease, dis-ease among our young people, a place of violence, and a place of cultivating a spirit of materialism. But it could be turned around, and needless to say, thankfully there are popular musicians who are at least utilizing the music, the medium, to pass on messages that do inspire positive growth. But it needs to happen, I believe, across the board in film, in television, in all of the arts. I did a production for years called Stepping Into Tomorrow, where we worked specifically in settings that supported the growth of young people. We had the opportunity to see the light go on for many of them. It was truly, truly amazing. More and more of that kind of thing needs to happen in our society. We need to use that power in a constructive way.
We'll be right back. One man washed on an empty beach. One man betrayed with a kiss.
I'm Carol Boss, and I'm talking with Yolanda King, the eldest daughter of Martin Luther King Jr. I was just curious what you thought your father's foremost concerns would be in today's world and the challenges for him.
I have to always say before I answer questions like that, you know, my father was ahead of his time when he was with us. And so who knows where his focus would be. It's hard to say, but I certainly believe that one of the things that he would be most concerned about is the fact that we continue to be so bent on using militarism to solve every problem that we have. That's one of the things that I know he would be focusing on, reminding us so strongly that this is just, it's never worked. It's all it does is create vengeance and vindictiveness. I know that would be an issue, as well as the fact that the gulf between the haves and the have-nots still remains far too large, and that those two issues he was championing at the end of his days, and unfortunately, we continue to be plagued by them.
Thank you very much, Ms. King, for joining us today.
Yes.
Thanks
thank
a million.
You. Alrighty. Be
okay,
well.
Yeah, you too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Alrighty. Bye-bye.
We shall overcome.
My Lord.
We shall overcome.
There's a little song that we sing in our movement down in the South. I don't know if you've heard it. It has become the theme song. we shall overcome. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Though I join hands so often with students and others behind jail bars singing it, we shall overcome. Sometimes we've had tears in our eyes when we joined together to sing it, but we still decided to sing it. We shall overcome. No, before this victory is won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome. Don't worry about us. Before the victory is won, some of us will lose jobs, but we shall overcome. Before the victory is won, even some will have to face physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children from a permanent psychological death, then nothing shall be more redemptive. We shall overcome. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. And with this faith, we will go out and adjourn the councils of despair and bring new light into the dark chambers of pessimism. And we will be able to rise from the fatigue of despair to the buoyancy of hope. And this will be a great America. We will be the participants in making it so. And so as I leave you this evening, I say, walk together, children. Don't you get weary. There's a great camp meeting in the commons.
You've been listening to Martin Luther King Jr.'s Path to Nonviolence. For more information about Yolanda King's work, visit her online at yolanda-king.com. That's yolanda-king.com. She was interviewed by Carol Boss. Music in our program included U2's Pride in the Name of Love from the CD Rattle and Hum. Also, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee Freedom Singers from the Smithsonian Folkways CD called Voices of the Civil Rights Movement. Dr. King's speeches came from The Wisdom of King, a Black Label Incorporated cassette collection no longer available. This program was produced by Good Radio Shows Incorporated, online at goodradioshows.org. We had assistance from KUNM at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks for listening.